A stunning order by the International Court of Justice puts more pressure on Israel over its campaign in Gaza.
The court considers that, in conformity with the obligations under the Genocide Convention, Israel must immediately halt its military offensive and any other action in the Rafah Governorate.
Also this week, three European nations announced they'll recognize Palestinian statehood.
This European wave, hopefully, will be followed by other waves. The support to the state of Palestine, its admission to the UN and recognition is taking momentum.
And Israel's military says it has recovered three more bodies of hostages being held in Gaza. Today is Saturday, May 25th. Join us as we explore the issues in the news. Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London in Washington. Judges at the top United Nations court Friday issued a landmark emergency ruling.
The court considered that, in conformity with the obligations under the Genocide Convention, Israel must immediately halt its military offensive and any other action in the Rafah Governorate, which may inflict on the Palestinian group in Gaza conditions of life that could bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part.
The International Court of Justice ordered Israel also to open the Rafah crossing between Egypt and Gaza to let in aid. Israel, it added, must provide access for investigators and report back on its progress within 1 month.
The court is not convinced that the evacuation efforts and related measures that Israel affirms to have undertaken to enhance the security of civilians in the Gaza Strip, and in particular those recently displaced from the Rafah Governorate, are sufficient to alleviate the immense risk to which the Palestinian population is exposed as a result of the military offensive in Rafah.
In January, ICJ judges ordered Israel to do all it can to prevent death, destruction, and any acts of genocide in Gaza, but stopped short of ordering an end to the military offensive. Ahead of the court's decision, on Thursday, Israeli government spokesman Avi Haiman said Israel will not be deterred.
No power on earth will stop Israel from protecting its citizens and going after Hamas in Gaza. We will destroy Hamas. We will return peace and security to the people of Israel and to the people of Gaza. We cannot go on with a genocidal terrorist regime on our southern border.
Friday's ruling, however, was welcomed by Palestinian envoy Riyad Mansour.
We also welcome the fact that they called for the opening of Rafah crossing, for providing humanitarian assistance to scale and to continue fighting against the crime against humanity of mass transfer, including the pushing of 800,000 of Palestinians around Rafah to move to other parts of the Gaza Strip.
The decision followed another dramatic move by the International Criminal Court earlier in the week. On Monday, its chief prosecutor, Karim Khan, said he would seek approval of arrest warrants for leaders of Hamas and Israel, including Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. The allegations included starvation of civilians and willfully causing great suffering. But in an appearance on ABC's Good Morning America Tuesday, Netanyahu rejected Khan's decision.
It's a hit job. It's not serious. He's out to defame Israel. And he's also pouring gasoline on the fires of anti-Semitism that are spreading around the world, because he is attacking the one and only Jewish state and trying to handcuff us, preventing us from exercising responsibly through the laws of war as we obey them and we are subordinate to them. He's saying we're not. He's creating false symmetry, false facts, and he's doing a grave injustice to the international court.
Joining us now to unpack all of this is Leila Sadat, professor of international criminal law at Washington University and former special advisor on crimes against humanity to the ICC prosecutor. So what's your initial reaction to Friday's World Court ruling?
I think that it's a blockbuster ruling, actually. Not unanimous. It was 13-2. It's a blockbuster. I mean, South Africa did a very good job making its case to the court. Israel, I think, presented a very able defense, although it complained it hadn't had enough time. But I think the court did not accept Israel's version of what was happening, and it accepted South Africa's assessment of the situation.
Didn't South Africa ask for the court to order a ceasefire of the entire Gaza?
It did. It is not a full ceasefire. It is a cessation of the military operation in Rafah. And I think Judge Nolte's question to Israel at the very end of the oral hearing about what steps are you taking when you talk about evacuation of the civilian population there, how are you assuring their survival, basically, was the gist of his question. And I think there was no real answer to that, because the location to which the 800,000 individuals being moved is a location that does not currently support human habitation in any positive way, right? The infrastructure has been destroyed, access to water, access to food, fuel, electricity, hospital care. And so I think the court was really focused on what has changed, and what has changed is the attack on Rafah, which was sort of the last surviving enclave in Gaza that was able to limpingly sustain human life in some way. And that was South Africa. Basically, the case it made during the oral hearing was that's what's different. Sort of a Srebrenica-style argument, which is this is the last surviving enclave with some semblance of infrastructure, and pushing people out into these areas where it's just not clear how they would even sustain life is the difference. And the court agreed with that. Right. So that, I think, is astonishing, that the court said enough has changed since South Africa came to the court and since its March 28th order.
We've been hearing for weeks from international aid organizations, the UN, that famine is already happening in northern Gaza and that the entire territory is at risk.
And the other thing that was very shocking is for the aid organizations, that is particularly even in North Gaza, saying we can no longer deliver aid, right? The World Food Organization had said our warehouses are, we cannot deliver food. And the pier that was built is insufficient. So, you know, it's funny, we're talking about winners and losers. The only team to be on here is Team Humanity, right? So every time South Africa, in air quotes, wins, I feel like humanity is losing, because what that means is that the humanitarian situation has become so catastrophic that even a court as conservative as the International Court of Justice has said this has to stop in some measure.
And this decision is a part of a broader situation that is happening with the International Criminal Court filing charges against individuals it considers responsible for war crimes, crimes against humanity. Even the word genocide was used. And that was just Monday, days ago.
This is a really, really serious situation. And the fact that the ICC is involved, I think, should be welcomed. I know there's been some pushback to the arrest warrants, but this really needs to be welcomed, because the fighting and the casualty levels and the humanitarian crisis have spun completely out of control, bringing neither peace nor justice to the victims of either side. And so the ICC is really looking at accountability for the crimes committed on October 7th and since October 7th. And of course, the ICC has on its docket allegations of war crimes that were committed even prior to this in 2014, in 2018, in 2021. So this is a long-standing simmering conflict that has now spiraled. It's what I call an atrocity cascade, where if you don't staunch the atrocities in a fairly early phase, they spin completely out of control. So I think the entire international community, all of the institutions, are trying to bring a measured and judicious pressure to bear on the parties, including Hamas. The last thing the court said was, we want the hostages unconditionally and immediately released. And that, I think, would do a huge amount to at least take that issue off the table, right? It doesn't take the accountability issue. Why were they, you know, they shouldn't have been kidnapped in the first place, and the crimes alleged to have happened on October October 7th never should have happened. But I think the release of the hostages would at least allow perhaps some shift in thinking from the Israeli side.
Israel's been pretty defiant over the order ceasefire in Rafah, and also extremely angered over the arrest warrant, saying this is basically a sham and that they're doing everything they should be doing to protect themselves as a sovereign nation.
I understand that's Israel's legal position in front of the ICJ and with respect to the ICC is we are complying with humanitarian law. We're not violating it. We're bending over backwards. And the difficulty is that is simply not a credible assertion given the high casualty levels. And while it should never be a numbers game in these kind of atrocities, if you compare the kill rates, even in the Ukraine situation, if you look at what happened in the former Yugoslavia, which was a conflict that involved aerial bombardment of civilian areas, you just didn't see this kind of casualty level. And Israel's argument has been, well, Hamas is shielding, right? They're using human shields, and that's why the casualties are so high here. But in fact, we know that the level of collateral damage that Israel accepts with respect to strikes is grossly disproportionate to what is realistically acceptable under humanitarian law. There was a great piece in Just Security analyzing the sort of level of collateral damage that Israel is willing to tolerate to get one low-level Hamas leader. How many civilians is an acceptable number killed? And the numbers are extraordinarily high and just not consistent with humanitarian law's admonition that states are required to take all feasible precautions. And it's certainly feasible not to kill so many people. It really has gotten into a war that is not consistent with humanitarian law. I don't think there's any other way to say that. Now, crimes against humanity and genocide, those have different elements. And so we have to look at whether this is an attack against the civilian population. The ICC prosecutor has determined that it is. Whether he'll get his arrest warrants and whether that'll be proven in court, that's another issue. And he did not charge genocide, interestingly. Instead, he charged the crime of extermination. So that's not an easy crime to prove. There's never been a case involving extermination at the ICC. And there's only one arrest warrant that contains the word, and that's the arrest warrant against Omar al-Bashir, the former president of Sudan. And that's the only case in which extermination has been charged as a crime against humanity, because it is sort of akin to genocide. It's a mass killing. It's a mass extermination.
Extermination is pretty intense.
The word extermination is really intense. And remember, at Nuremberg, it was extermination. There was no genocide charge at Nuremberg. The Genocide Convention hadn't yet been adopted. So the crime against humanity of extermination is an extraordinarily serious charge. And he leveled it not just at Israel, he leveled it at Hamas, which I think is interesting. So that will be one that we'll be watching very closely, because as I said, we've never had an extermination case at the ICC, and it's only in one arrest warrant that has not yet been executed because we can't get, you know, at the ICC, custody of the accused.
What ability does the ICJ or the ICC have to enforce any of this?
The International Court of Justice has an enforcement mechanism, but it's the UN Security Council. And the United States has already vetoed several resolutions relating to the conflict and would be unlikely to not veto if it was brought to the Council that Israel was in noncompliance, and I suspect it will be. I think we can probably expect another American veto. We have seen this is an issue with provisional measures orders at the International Court of Justice, where they involve the use of force, noncompliance is pretty high. That was true for Russia, was ordered to stop its invasion of Ukraine, and it did not. And that's not the only situation. We just don't have a good way of forcing states to the peace table. That said, it is kind of a mark of shame. Russia has become very diplomatically isolated at the United Nations because of its failure to comply with basic principles of international law. It's actually been expelled from the Council of Europe, and I think it's suffering severe consequences in terms of its international reputation, its ability to get support at the United Nations for things that are important to it. Israel is going to suffer the same consequence. It's more of a social shunning than it is direct enforcement. There could also be sanctions. They're not from the United States, obviously, but other states are under tremendous pressure now, not, for example, to sell weapons to Israel. So I think for Israel, the really sad consequence of this is to the extent it sees itself as part of the Western group of countries, right, as a democracy, it becomes even more diplomatically and sort of socially isolated. It's a terrible consequence of this in that it obviously has its view. I'm not an expert on Israeli politics, but its view is clearly not shared by the family of nations. And so it's very difficult because it finds itself increasingly isolated because of that. The ICC arrest warrants have direct consequences because they don't target states, they target people. Israel doesn't have to comply with the ICC arrest warrants because it's not a party to the ICC, although I'm sure that many in Israel welcome the arrest warrants against the Hamas individuals. But all the states' parties to the ICC do have to cooperate with the court, and they have to implement those arrest warrants. And so that can cut down very heavily on a leader or an individual's ability to travel because they can be arrested pursuant to an Interpol red notice and the international arrest warrant issuing from the court.
The United States is not a part of the ICC, but if
that's right,
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu were to travel to one of the countries that is a member, they would be required to arrest him.
That's correct.
Leila Sadat, professor of international criminal law at Washington University and former special advisor on crimes against humanity to the International Criminal Court prosecutor. Thank you so much for being with us. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. Well, adding to the pile-on over concerns of Israel's conduct in Gaza came another stinging announcement this week. Palestinian UN envoy Riyad Mansour.
It is a wonderful omen as we assemble today that we received very positive news from Europe that Spain, Ireland, and Norway declared today that they will be recognizing the state of Palestine on the 28th of this month.
For insights into what, if any, momentum this could bring toward ending the war, I spoke with Brian Koutoulis, Senior Fellow for U.S. Foreign Policy at the Middle East Institute, who was attending meetings in Doha, Qatar.
The move, I think, is mostly symbolic, but the symbolism is powerful, and it sends the message to Israel and the United States and other countries around the world. A growing number of them are committed to see a two-state solution, to see the creation of a state called Palestine. And even though this move does not change any of the realities on the ground, which are quite grim, it's a signal, especially to the Israeli leadership of the current government, that there are voices in the international community who want to see a clear path to a two-state solution.
Does it put pressure on Israel to bring the war to an end?
I don't think so, because Israel's leaders, whether it's Netanyahu or Gallant or anyone who comes after them, will mostly respond to two main things: the security conditions their country is experiencing in the region, which are still pretty bad. You know, they're experiencing daily rocket attacks from either Gaza or Lebanon or even Syria. And they'll also respond to the pressures from their own people. And as far as we can see from measures of Israeli public sentiment, including Israeli Arabs, there's still pretty strong majority support for Israel's military operation in Gaza, in part because they feel the threat that everyone witnessed on October 7th, but also because of the hostages that still remain in the hands of Hamas and other groups in Gaza.
And, you know, the question of statehood, one of the reasons Israel has been pushing back so hard is that people feel like any discussion of statehood is rewarding Hamas in some way?
That's a concern, but the real reward to Hamas came for more than a decade when Benjamin Netanyahu and several Israeli leaders actually rewarded Hamas with funding from Qatar, and they were part of that arrangement that helped keep Hamas in power in Gaza. So I think the real challenge with that way of thinking is that it's stuck in the past and doesn't actually recognize the legitimate concerns of ordinary Palestinians, many of whom don't support Hamas and just want to live a life in peace and dignity. So to me, I understand the sentiment given the trauma of October 7th and the hostages and the enduring trauma trauma of that. But it also, I think leaders need to lead their people to a better situation. And it's hard to conceive of something better in the current pathway that Israel is on, which seems to be a road to nowhere but endless war and perhaps reoccupation of Gaza. So I think the bold move by a bold leader would be to accept what I see the United States and the Biden administration working with countries like Saudi Arabia and others in the Arab world trying to do, which is create a pathway, long-term pathway, but a pathway to a two-state solution.
At this point, it doesn't seem like Israel is outwardly anyway expressing any openness to shifting their strategy thus far, even with the outside pressure.
Pressure doesn't really produce lasting peace. It's never has in the Middle East. What does is the realization between the parties of a conflict that war is actually more destructive to their self-interest than a pathway to peace. And right now, I think Israel, as well as Hamas, are still caught up in an existential fight with each other. And the costs are mostly being borne by ordinary Palestinians living in Gaza. They're also being borne by many Israelis who have family members who are in combat in Gaza. And this is the box that they're in right now. And history shows us there's very little when it comes to pressure, especially when it comes to pressure on countries that feel threatened, that these moves, though I think say important things about how many in the international community see Israel's actions right now, I don't think they amount to much in terms of ending the conflict. The warning and concerns that several Biden administration officials have raised for several months now about the lack of a clear plan by Israel to go after the Hamas militants in a way that actually enhances civilian protections and also deals with the growing humanitarian crisis. And it doesn't seem like there's a credible plan. And it also doesn't seem like the Biden administration is going to use much leverage to try to change Israel's trajectory here, unless there's some sort of surprise move on the part of the Biden administration. So the simple point is that Hamas could very easily end this conflict by saying they would accept the ceasefire that was on offer and the on-again, off-again talks for 5 months and release hostages in exchange for prisoners. So this is the problem. Hamas itself is also to blame by shielding itself with innocent Palestinians and trying to stay in the power. So there are no good actors in this. And I think it's an unfortunate consequence of this type of asymmetric war that a terrorist group uses against a country like Israel. And Israel responds in a way that its people want them to defend themselves. But ultimately, it doesn't seem to be producing a pathway to anywhere but an endless war.
We're hearing that there is a potential for restarting ceasefire talks. Have you heard anything about that?
You know, I was in sessions here. They're off the record sessions, but I was in sessions with regional diplomats. And there hasn't been a day that's gone by, I would say, since the last ceasefire in late November, early December last year collapsed because Hamas restarted the attacks against Israel. So every day there's some new initiative, even when it, you know, the recent spurt of diplomacy kind of died down. There are always people who are trying to construct that pathway, whether it's from Qataris here or Egyptians or U.S. officials. The challenge with these talks is that it's not just about the release of several hundred hostages in exchange for prisoners, several hundred in total. I mean, there's only about maybe 40 or 60 hostages left, but the Hamas group expects several hundred prisoners to be released by Israel. The talks are also about setting the contours of what would be a more lasting ceasefire than just more than 6 weeks. And in that context, there are a lot of issues that either Israel or Hamas tries to add to the negotiation, including the positioning of Israeli troops, whether they would withdraw fully, how much freedom of movement Palestinians would have throughout the Gaza Strip, what sort of measures might be put into place to disarm Hamas as a security threat. And that's what makes these talks very complicated. So I see that they're going to try to do this again, but ultimately it comes up to the leaders of Israel and Hamas to try to find a pathway here.
Brian Katula, Senior Fellow for U.S. Foreign Policy at the Middle East Institute, speaking to us from Doha, Qatar. Thank you so much. And finally, early Friday, Israeli military spokesman Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari said the bodies of three more hostages killed on October 7th had been recovered.
It is with a heavy heart that I share that last night, Israeli special forces in Gaza rescued the bodies of our hostages, Hanania Vlonka, Michelle Nissenbaum, Orion Hernandez. Their bodies were rescued during a special operation based on precise intelligence.
The army said they were killed on the day of the attack and their bodies had been taken to Gaza.
There are men, women, children, and babies being held by Hamas in living hell across our border in Gaza. We will not stop fighting for their freedom. Every decent country in the world would do the same.
The announcement comes less than a week after the army said it had found the bodies of four other hostages, also killed on October 7th. And while a large majority of Israelis support military operations in Gaza, anger is growing at home over the government's handling of the hostage crisis. And that's all the time we have this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thank you very much for listening. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.